So what do you actually have in the barrels? Just you got whiskey, you got some other things going on in there?
These are empty whiskey barrels that were taken to a brewery in Chicago. They're going to fill them with beer.
Everybody's doing some crazy things with barrels nowadays because, yeah, it's like you're giving to the beer, and then like once they're done with the beer, they might give them back to you, and then you'll put some other kind of like whiskey, but it can't be called a bourbon in it, or all this other kind of stuff. Everybody's just doing something different nowadays.
Yeah, we just did one of those projects with Bent River Brewing in Rock Island, Illinois. They have a coffee stout that they call Uncommon Stout, and they took the barrels, aged the stout, released it, gave the barrels back to us. We put our Cody Road bourbon in it, aged it for another 6 months, and called it Cody Road Double Barrel.
This episode of Bourbon Pursuit is made possible through listeners like you, supported through Patreon. Hey everyone, this was a big week as all the fellows from the Bourbon Community Roundtable came into Louisville for 2 days of drinking and barrel picking. We had lots of good conversations about working closer together in the upcoming months and how we can bring more content. With that being said, if you're a supporter of the podcast on Patreon, be on the lookout for a message soon about reserving your bottle from this barrel pick. There's not going to be enough to go around, but we wanted to make it as fair as possible. Hats off to everyone at Buffalo Trace for accommodating us, and you can expect to see a video compiled of the pick as well from our new friend Jerry over at PerfectPourTV.com. Also, special thanks to Brent Elliott of Four Roses, who invited us out to come just hang out in the Four Roses lab and drink some samples of stuff that he had pulled from multiple warehouses with a lot of varied age ranges. We hope you're able to follow along if you're following Bourboner, Breaking Bourbon, or us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For this episode, we touch more on the fascination with boutique whiskeys, and this one is no exception. Mississippi River Distilling is doing some great things as they're teaming up with other distillers to create some new expressions for the market. If you enjoy the grain to glass story, then you're going to love this episode. So make sure you support the show on Patreon, make sure you're subscribing on iTunes, YouTube, and Facebook, and make sure you enjoy this week's episode. Welcome back to another episode of the Bourbon Pursuit Podcast, the official podcast of bourbon. Just Kenny here, riding solo. Ryan was supposed to join us today, but we've got another Ryan here as our guest. And there was just a little bit of a scheduling conflict. I think it's a hard thing that we always try to do. We try to cram a lot of these recordings at once, and then we get mixed up in time zones. And then when you deal with different people, all these different things happen. But I think today's going to be a good episode because, you know, we haven't had a good representation of craft distillers on lately. So I'm very happy to actually have another one on and kind of talk about what they're doing, what's unique, the different things that you can get out of what they're building versus what you do when you come to Kentucky and see all the big boys on the bourbon trail. So today we have one of the master distillers over at the Mississippi River Distilling Company, Ryan Burchett. So Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks. So glad to be here.
Did I butcher your last name at all, or was I okay there?
No, that's pretty good. Yeah.
So I want to kind of talk about you for a minute. So kind of talk about just, you know, how you grew up, or is it around spirits, or is this just like a crazy idea you had off at a whim? Because I know people are always like, oh, I just wanted to be a bartender in college. So when I grew up, I just opened a bar.
Right. Well, our story fits a little of both, I guess, in that front, in that my brother and I are partners in this operation, my brother Garrett, and we did not have a long history in spirits per se, but we did have a history in small business, family business. And we grew up, my dad and his three brothers owned a road construction company together, and so all through junior high and then eventually high school and college, we spent working around the family business and that kind of thing. We didn't realize what we learned about running a family business until after we started our own, but we'd been exposed to that and we're open to it. And as our careers progressed, we both grew up in Western Iowa, kind of halfway between Omaha, Nebraska, and Des Moines, and rural area. And we were both in other careers. My brother used to design highways. He was living in Dallas, Texas. I was a TV weatherman for 15 years around the country, mainly in Iowa, spent a couple years in Louisiana. And we're back in Iowa and had kind of decided that we wanted to settle down. We're starting to have kids and that kind of thing. And my industry, TV, was a transient business and was kind of sick and tired of moving around, wanted to be able to raise some kids a little closer to family and that kind of thing. And so it had been illegal in Iowa prior to 2010 to taste or buy spirits at a distillery. You could distill. But for the tourist side of it, was you really weren't going to be able to get it done. And so this law change was potentially out there, and we were thinking, wow, this might be a chance to get in on the ground level of something really cool. And started doing some training, learning more about spirits and how to make them and that kind of thing, and writing a business plan, thinking that if the worst thing that ever happened was we learned more about whiskey, well, that was still really cool. And after a couple years of that, the law was changing. We had a local bank interested, and we figured once a bank was on board, we must have really figured something out. And that was, we opened our distillery, Mississippi River Distilling Company, on the banks of the Mississippi River in a little town called LeClaire, Iowa, which no one's ever heard of unless you watch American Pickers. We're about three blocks from where they shoot that show. But we're right outside of Davenport, Iowa, the Quad Cities area. And we opened this week, 7 years ago. And it's been a wild ride, and we geared it towards tourism, kind of taking advantage of that law. We wanted people to be able to come and see how we did it. And then once we decided that we were going to open our doors and pull back the curtain and let people experience it that way, then we needed to make sure that we gave them the opportunity to see it all and to really be authentic about what we do. So we use local grain sourced from farmers all within 25 miles of our distillery. We mill it on site. We mash it on site. We distill it. We blend it. We bottle it. It all happens at our facility in Little LeClaire, Iowa. So that's what got us here, I guess.
So that's real cool. I think, you know, there's one other thing, you know, you talked about LeClaire being pretty small. I remember Davenport being in one of my favorite movies of all time. Can you remember what that is?
Which one? I don't know.
Tommy Boy. Do you remember? Oh. He goes, I'm in Davenport, Iowa. You need a new map, right? that was one thing that I always remember. So that's real cool that you kind of look at it as more of a, you saw an opportunity there, right? So it didn't sound like you had a, you know, being a weatherman, I mean, you came from a completely different angle. So I guess kind of talk first about like the weather in Iowa and how that kind of plays a key role in this, right? Because I think, you know, we all talk about it in Kentucky. You're like, oh, the hot summers, the cold winters, it does this and this, you know, but you're a weatherman, like you know exactly what's happening here. So I kind of want to get your idea of the weather in Iowa and how that's playing a role into your process as well.
Well, I think more specifically than just the weather, our climate obviously lends itself really well to growing things like corn. We have some of the best grain in the world right outside our back door, literally. So that's been the biggest thing, is the availability of the grain, and that we were able to find it close by. We're not trucking it in from Timbuktu or anything like that. We literally know every one of our farmers by name. We can tell you the field that this stuff came from. We can tell you when it was grown, you know, where it was stored, everything about it. And so, you know, more than weather has probably influenced it, it's been more the agriculture and the industry here. But that said, we do take a much different approach from an aging standpoint and that kind of thing, specifically as far as whiskey goes, in that we don't look for the huge temperature swings and that kind of thing. We don't climate control per se, but our aging happens basically underground in a bunker that we built that holds our whiskey barrels. And we try to keep it between about 55 and 75 degrees during the year. So there is some swing, but we're not aging in these big rick houses that are 20 stories tall and things like that. And we're aging in 30-gallon barrels instead of a 58-gallon barrel, things like that. And that's been one of the big things that we've tried to help people understand through education of our tours and when we're out and about, is that, you know, when you walk into a room and you set down a bottle of whiskey, if the first question that comes out of your mouth is, how old is it? You really haven't established anything about how that whiskey was made, how it was aged, what happened with it along the way, other than How long did it sit around? And I think that there's a whole lot of other questions that you can ask that's going to peel back the onion and help you understand what makes this bottle different or special or out of the ordinary compared to everything else that's on the shelf in front of you. And what's really cool is over the past 7 years, as we've been in this industry, we've watched the marketplace go from you're making your own whiskey to tell me more about, you know, are you guys green to glass? Are you this or that? So the consumers and the buyers are becoming much more educated. And I think that it's opening the marketplace to a variety that probably has not been seen in the United States prior to right now.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really interesting when you said that, you know, I think I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this because, you know, we've got a lot of people that are very keen to saying like, oh, they love to see an age statement on a bottle and stuff like that. And then you also kind of flipped it and you said, you know, the way that you age your barrels is basically it's underground. It's almost temperature regulated. If anybody's ever been to a cave, that's kind of how it really works. And the real interesting thing to this is that when you get into older, higher age whiskeys, whether they're in the 20 plus year category, most of these whiskeys are the ones that are actually in the middle of the warehouse where they don't see a huge or a lot of those temperature fluctuations, right? So that's why they actually have whiskey still left in the barrel to actually bottle at that point. So I think it's a really unique way that you could be looking at kind of creating the way I look at it is I don't want to say hyper aging, but it could be looking at something that could be relatively close to something that is older because it's not hitting those temperature fluctuations, but it's sitting in a warehouse that's been there for a while. And not only that is, you know, using a smaller barrel size tries to relieve and, you know, kind of make that difference as well, right?
Yeah, it does. It's a different way of doing it. And I think that's what our challenge has been from a craft standpoint is helping people to understand. And I liken it to, you know, when craft beer came along, 20, 25 years ago, you know, you had light beer out there and Budweiser and Bud Light or whatever, Miller Lite. And, you know, Sam Adams came along and they said, drink better beer. And they were right because it had flavor and it was big and it was different. And from craft spirits, I'm not going to walk into the room and look you in the eye and say, don't drink Woodford Reserve because that stuff is garbage. You know, it's ridiculous. It's not the case. But what I will tell you is that 90%+ of America's whiskey is made in virtually the same fashion in a similar still, in a similar, you know, in a tradition that has been the same way for a really long time. They make really, really good spirits. I like to drink them too. But what craft is bringing to the table is a different approach that's going to bring you different flavors and different ways to experience some of these familiarities from a spirit that you haven't before. And that's what we're trying to do. You know, if 20 years ago you put an IPA in front of somebody, they would have spit it out through their nose. Like, what in the hell is this garbage? You know, but people's tastes have been broadened to a point now that some of these, you know, out of the ordinary flavors are mainstream again. And so what I think is exciting about craft is that we are opening a book to what is probably more akin to the way that spirits were made in this country, 80, 90, 100 years ago. And that's our approach at Mississippi River Distilling with our Cody Road whiskeys. We do age in a 30-gallon cask, and our stuff is about 2 years old. But what we do differently is we've taken a very European approach to our distillation method, and that is we trained in Germany with the company that built our still, and we push the proof. Like on our bourbon, we're riding right up to 160 so that, you know, we have as clean of a spirit as possible going into the barrel. It's a small batch approach. It's not a continuous still. It's a pot still. We run it through a couple plates. And so we have, when we started, we knew we were laying down whiskey. We knew it was a smooth spirit coming off the still. We didn't know what it was going to taste like once it had a couple years under its belt. So, you know, from a business perspective, you're really placing a gamble here. But if it's a quality spirit going into the barrel, it's going to be even better coming out of the barrel.
So talk about then, that gamble. Talk about that gamble a little bit. I mean, like, as you know, you said, I mean, that's one of the biggest things in craft distilling, right? Is you are making a gamble. Right. And kind of talk about, you know, what that is, what the kind of the product has turned into since you've been able to test it out or try it out from your distillation.
Well, yeah, when you're running a brewery and you make a beer and you put it in a bottle, you sell it. When you're running a distillery and the market is whiskey, we all know that. You're putting it in a barrel and you're sitting on it for a couple of years. So I always joke, could we just sit around and make some money for a change instead of, you know, my retirement is sitting in a barrel room downstairs right now. And, you know, it's nice now that we've got a few more years under our belt that, there's things going into the barrel room, but it's also coming out and you can realize some of that, cash flow back into the operation. But it is a very cash intensive industry to get into, especially as a small player, to be able to make that investment and to hang on with it through the years. But, you know, we made some decisions really early on, almost unwittingly. We went into the barrel at a pretty low proof. Our bourbon whiskey goes into the barrel at 110. Our rye goes in at 96 usually. We bottle the bourbon at 90. We bottle the rye at 80. The reason we did that is because from the beginning, we did not want to add any coloring to the whiskey, and we wanted to make sure that we weren't adding a whole lot of water on the back end. You know, people may or may not realize most whiskey goes into the barrel at the legal maximum of 125 and then is watered down after it comes out to get it down to the appropriate bottle proof, you know, usually 80, 90, whatever it might be. By using a lower proof, then we add very little water coming out of the barrel so that we have the color, but almost virtually everything in our bottles has interacted with oak. And if you've messed around with craft spirits much, people have used 5 gallon, 10 gallon, 15 gallon barrels, you can get a real astringency out of oak if it's not in balance, if it's too much char, not enough of the sugar from the oak and that kind of thing. And we found that the sugars from the oak dissolve much better in water than they do in alcohol. And at a lower proof, we're getting a nice balance out of that smaller barrel. And in a 2-year time frame, what we're finding at 24 to 36 months seems to be the prime spot with these barrels. We've got some barrels, and we're not, we almost like some of the younger whiskey a little bit better. They're a little sweeter and they're in balance. And that, again, I get people who will ask me, well, are you going to have a 7-year, a 10-year, something like that? Well, we could do that, but we would have to make the whiskey completely different. It's going to sit in the barrel that long. We need it to have a rougher edge on it, a stronger backbone going into the barrel so that it's going to last that long and come out not tasting like toothpicks and that kind of thing. So again, it's not as simple as how old is it? It's what proof did it go into the barrel? What proof did it come out of the barrel? What size of barrel did you use? What char of a barrel did you use? All of these different things. And what's really fascinating is you can lay down a spirit made the same day from the same mash tank, you know, same fermenter, everything, put it in two different barrels and you're going to have two different whiskeys when it comes out. And I think that's one of the really remarkable things that I really appreciate about what goes on in Kentucky at some of these large distilleries is the product consistency that they're able to achieve by blending literally millions of barrels every year and to be able to bring that product to market again and again. So it tastes just the way that you remember it the last time you had it. It's really remarkable.
I think, you know, one thing that you talked about, so you guys do entry at 125 proof. Is that what you said?
We go in at 110. Most American whiskey does go in at 125.
Yeah. I've heard up to 160 at some places too. So I know it can be up there, but so did I also hear you do a difference in the entry proof between your rye and your bourbon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The rye goes in even lower. It gets bottled lower. So that's why we started lower there.
Well, kind of talk about the reasoning behind it of why you wanted to go with an entry proof that's a little bit lower. This is actually a question that came from a Patreon member who's watching this live right now.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to we wanted to be authentic, and I did not want to where we felt like we needed to add any coloring or anything to it. So when you take a spirit out of the barrel and you add 20% water, well, you're going to wash away a lot of your color that way. It's just going to look lighter in the bottle. And so, you know, it was from that it started, that let's try to be in a situation where we don't have to add much blending water. Now, we lose some proof during aging, so you got to come in high. so that you have some room for the angel share to come back down. But by doing that and then experimenting later with some other barrel entry proofs, we found very consistently that the lower barrel proofs were giving us a much sweeter, a much more balanced whiskey that that really worked well for what we were doing. Our bourbon is a wheated bourbon, so it's a little sweeter coming in anyway. So when we messed around with the barrel proof, we found that pushing it up just did not give us as well-rounded of a whiskey, and we stuck with it from the beginning.
So talk about the process that you went through in trying to figure out what your entry proof is going to be and what your bottling proof is going to be, because it sounds like you had all these experiments that were going on, and I know that you can taste something off the still and it tastes great, and then it can taste bad, right? But it was, as you had mentioned already, as soon as it hits the wood and you age it for 3, 6, 9 months, even 2 years, all that is going to change drastically. So kind of talk about your process of what you did in, you know, really honing in and figuring out what is it that you guys are going to try to make a consistent product out of.
Well, I'd love to tell you that I was some kind of a genius from the beginning and I had us all figured out and we just knew exactly what we were going for. Unfortunately, as my wife will tell you, I am not a genius. But
don't worry, it doesn't matter who you're married to. I get it as well. Yeah.
right. She's way cooler than me, don't take me wrong. But anyway, the low barrel proof we started with, when we came out with even some of our early on, you know, just kind of experimenting, let's get into this barrel a little bit, we found early on that we liked those barrels better. As we went forward to a point that we were getting ready to release some whiskey, and we released some whiskey at about between 12 and 15 months, 5+ years ago when we first got started. We found that proof at 80 on the bourbon that was going in at 110 and it was coming out about 106, 107 after a year. We found out that it was like, it was just almost too mild at 80 proof. You put a couple ice cubes in it and was like, where was the whiskey? It didn't have enough backbone in it. And so we bumped it up to 90 proof for our bottling at the very beginning. And that just gave it enough spine that, you know, it could hold up to a couple drops of water, hold up to some ice cubes. Now, our whiskeys, when we first came out with them, were obviously very grain forward at that younger age. But we liked them and they were different. And we got a pretty good response. They're very smooth and clean in the way that we distill them. And now as we've gone forward, we stuck with that just because that's what we had on our label and that kind of thing. But it's worked out really well. I'm pleased with the bourbon at 90. And the flip side of that is our rye, we go at a lower proof at 80 proof because our rye is much more akin to, I'd say, a full-flavored Canadian whiskey than a typical American rye that's going to be really big and spicy. Ours is very clean, light. You find some fruit notes in rye that you're just not going to find elsewhere. It's got some apple, banana, pear, and then the spice just kind of lingers in the back. And we're trying to go for a style and a flavor that was going to be different than everything else on the shelf. As a small guy, you kind of have a choice to make. Am I going to try to be something that everybody is going to be familiar with and they're going to want to buy a lot of it? Or am I going to try to take a different tack to the marketplace and provide something that is different than all these other bottles over here? And that's kind of the way we went with it. And so for the rye, it worked much better to bring out those sweet flavors, those fruit flavors at a lower proof than it did at a higher proof. So those two spirits kind of evolved differently in that way.
You know, we've talked about your process a lot, and I don't think we've gotten you the ability to kind of talk about your product. So, you know, you mentioned Cody Road, you mentioned your rye and your bourbon, but you guys do more than that there. So I want you to give you an opportunity to kind of talk about the different product sets that you guys have available to you and what you are distilling.
Right. Well, because we started off as a kind of a tourist opportunity for folks, that meant we kind of need to have a little bit of everything for people to come and try and see. And so we started off, we were making whiskey, but that was going into barrels, obviously. And so we had to have something to sell in the meantime. So we started off with vodka, gin, tying to the history of the river. The Cody Road, the name comes from Buffalo Bill Cody, was born just a few blocks from our distillery. And the distillery sits on Cody Road. We couldn't trademark Buffalo Bill's name, so we went with Cody Road. That worked out well. But The other stuff we kind of tried to the history. We have our River Pilot vodka, River Rose gin, and a River Baron artisan spirit. What the heck is an artisan spirit? People ask me all the time. This kind of
that's what I was going to say. I was like, I looked at the website and I was like, I don't think I've heard of artisan spirit before, right?
So it's kind of a funny story. It was it's kind of our take on an unaged whiskey, a white whiskey, but we just pushed the proof on it all the way up to vodka proof. We're distilling it at 190. But whereas a vodka would get distilled, charcoal filtered, redistilled to chase off all the flavor of the grain, we're distilling it once and then stopping. So it keeps that sweet vanilla butterscotch taste from corn and wheat, but it's smooth like a vodka. So when we went to the TTB with it, they were like, well, you can't call this vodka because it's not odorless and flavorless. You can't call it flavored vodka because no flavor is added. It occurred naturally. You can't call it whiskey, a white whiskey, because it's distilled at too high a proof. So we went round and round and finally, well, what can we call it? Well, you can call it alcohol distilled from grain. Well, great. Everyone thinks we're selling Everclear now, you know?
Yeah.
And so they're like, well, it's a distilled spirit specialty, so you can give it a fanciful name. And so we call it an artisan spirit.
And you said, is that bottled at 190 as well?
No. We bottle it at 80 proof, but we distill it at 190. So that's how we get the clean, you know, smoothness to it. But what we sell a lot of it at the distillery. Once people hear what it is and try it, they really like it. It's a hard product to sell out in the marketplace, obviously, because it's you don't know what it is right off. But what we find is, you know, like if I'm having a vodka tonic or a martini, then I want a traditional neutral vodka. And we do that with the River Pilot. If we're mixing it with something, you know, some fruit juice, something like that, even in a Bloody Mary or something, there's a flavor there with that spirit in the background that you can bring through in a cocktail instead of just having it disappear. And so that one I like that way. Our gin, River Rose, comes from an old German recipe. The guys in Germany we consulted with on most of our recipes, they found it in an old German textbook from the late 1800s. We told them we wanted a gin that was in the style lighter on juniper and maybe some different botanicals, something off the beaten path. And they said, well, we found this one. I think you'll like it. And it has a lot of citrus to it, a lot of floral. It has rose petal, lavender, cucumbers, and... So it's more in the vein of an American style gin than the traditional London dry. And then we've taken a tact of developing some kind of one-off products here and there. We call them seasonals, where we find a local ingredient and we try to figure out something cool to do with it. And then we might release, you know, anywhere from a couple hundred to a couple thousand bottles. And when they're gone, they're gone. Usually we take them through the local marketplace in Iowa and Illinois and kind of sometimes a little bit farther than that, but that's where most of it goes. But it's led us to, like, we do a coffee liqueur this time of year with a local coffee roaster. We do a honey-infused bourbon with a local beekeeper. We do a maple-infused bourbon with a local guy that has maple trees. So
I thought you were going to say we had just a Canadian around here that we use him for, right? Yeah.
You know, it's a funny story of the river, real quickly, of a guy. He has 500 acres that were, I think it's his third or fourth generation of his family, but his grandfather sold off all the oak trees 100 years ago because they would float down the river. The maple trees would not float. And so he basically cleared all of the acreage of oak trees, and now all they have left is maple trees. Well, next thing, now he's got a family business of tapping the maple trees, so it's been kind of funny.
That is interesting. You know, I think it's funny that you not really funny, but I think it's a good business move to talk about the different types of the seasonals that you do. I mean, like, right now is a great time for people that go out and get something that's coffee based because it's getting a little bit colder. When you get in the springtime, I mean, that honey is right there. It's perfect for making things like a Gold Rush or any of those kind of cocktails that do that. Now, with all your distilled spirits, are you using grain to glass on all these as well?
All of the alcohol is made from grain sourced from farmers within 25 miles of the place. And we put a little batch sticker on the side, and you can cross-reference that on our website with the batch notes for your bottle, and it'll tell you that the corn was grown by Ryan and Dan Clark of LeClaire, Iowa, and the wheat was grown by Tony Kenobi in Davenport, Iowa, and the Weary brothers in Fulton, Illinois, that kind of stuff. It's all, we're really trying to showcase the fact that it is truly local. And we found that that chain of ingredients is as important to a consumer in Davenport, Iowa, as it is to a consumer in Chicago, Illinois, or Dallas, Texas, or Minneapolis, or New York City. Even though it might not be local to them specifically, the fact that we're accountable for what's going into our bottles is really a huge selling point for us.
I mean, you look at that, I look at it with a very high level transparency, right? And saying that, you know, you're standing behind almost everything from the grain to the distilled spirit to everything, right? So you're standing behind the farmers that are locally growing it. You're standing behind the product in itself. You know, one of the things that, you know, I kind of want to get your take on this is, you know, we talked a lot of the big guys, right? And so grain to glass is something you hear very common in the craft movement. However, the bigger ones don't necessarily see it that way. They say, like, you know, we want to source basically as much grain as possible. It doesn't care where they come from as long as they have a good, high-quality product. But when I look at what you're doing something that also stimulates the local economy around you as well. So kind of talk about, like, your idea, the thought process of doing the grain to glass versus just doing, well, let's just go source everything, doesn't matter where it comes from.
Right. Well, I think it's the difference of a craft product. What the consumer is looking for in that product is different than what they expect from a mass-produced product. And I think that, number one, you're looking for a way to differentiate yourself. But we grew up, our business grew up during a time when most of the whiskey that was on the market in the craft industry was sourced whiskey. You know, it was being distilled at another distillery, brought in, put a different label on it. And we said, we want to stand out somebody that is doing it differently. We want to stand out as an authentic craft distillery from the very beginning. And we, you know, if you go to our website right now, it says that right on the front. We've kind of used that as a tagline. We want to be authentic. Be who you say you are. And I think that for some of the people in craft that have gotten in a little bit of trouble for some of this stuff, if they would have just done that from the beginning, they'd be fine. There's plenty of room in the marketplace for all different ways of skinning the cat. But be authentic about who you are. And we wanted to do that. And we live in a place in Iowa that is so rich in agriculture and in history surrounding that, that we're like, let's take advantage of that. Let's be a part of what is happening around us. And that is a lot of cornfields, but there's a lot of people who make their living in that. And we thought it was a way to try to tie to the authenticity of the place that we're from. You know, we're from a lot of cornfields, so we're going to make spirits out of corn. And, you know, we have some t-shirts in the gift shop and stuff that say, like our stuff, thank a farmer. And we really want to be a part of the history and the economy of the place that we're from that is uniquely Iowan. And so we've tried to do that in everything that we've set off to do.
So talk a little bit about what the, I guess you could say that the consumer rises in popularity of either bourbon or distilled spirits in your part of the country, right? I mean, I know that it's kind of exploding everywhere, but you know, we don't hear, I mean, I think you're easily our first guest, I think, that's been on from Iowa, right? So kind of talk about what's happening, you know, in the Midwest.
Well, I think that when we started 5-7 years ago now, we were right in the middle of that flavored vodka craze. And the volume that you saw going on around you of all these flavors and that kind of thing was just crazy. What I have really noticed, and it's everywhere, but I think the market's really changed here, is people's willingness to pay for a little bit better quality product. I think whereas before, if you ran across a whiskey drinker in this neck of the woods, they were probably drinking Jack or Jim or, you know, whatever, mixing it with Coke and whatnot. What's really changing is the palate of the younger consumer. And I'm going to say, you know, that 30 to 40 year old that maybe hadn't gotten into spirits yet, you know, 15 to 20 years ago, that age of consumer when, you know, 15, 20 years ago, that demographic may have skewed much more beer and that kind of thing. It seems like we're seeing a lot more young people that are taking to spirits. They're taking to quality spirits and they're much more adventurous than even in recent years. You know, people will go out to a bar. They might have a glass of wine with dinner. Then they might have a craft beer, and then they might have a cocktail, and then they might go back and have more wine. Who knows? They're not as tremendously brand loyal as generations before us. You know, where there was a guy who drank Jack and Coke every day of his life for 65 years. But I think that that adventurous attitude is beneficial, certainly to craft. You know, I don't see other craft producers necessarily as a huge competitor to us, as much as I want people to give something different a chance, to be more adventurous. Because if you're going to go do that, if you're going to go try a craft product and you like it, then the next bottle you buy will be mine, but the next bottle might be his. But if we all are doing this and changing people's palates, I think it will benefit everybody in the game.
So, you know, you kind of mentioned that not other crafts are really, like, you really see them as competitors. You guys are kind of all in this together. And not only that, is because a lot of the craft distillers and the craft movements out there, you know, they don't have national distribution or anything like that. So I want to give you the opportunity to talk to our listeners of where you're distributed at, what states can they find your products, everything like that.
Yeah. We're obviously primarily in the Midwest. We do well, Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Kansas, Missouri, Indiana. And then outside of that, Texas is a good state for us. Specs has gotten behind our products. If anybody's from Texas, they've heard of the chain of liquor store Specs, an independent set of stores. If you're in the Chicago area, Binney's carries our products. We're in New York City, is a good market for us. Washington, D.C., Baltimore area. So, you know, we're in about 20 states right now. And so it's kind of hit and miss. We're just putting the finishing touches on. We're partnering with a liquor store out of the Twin Cities to kind of provide for an online store for us, as you know, more and more people are trying to find us in between, and it's not quite up and running, but hopefully any day now. But that distribution is a real challenge for the small guys. And, you know, as a lot of consumers may not realize what's happening in the landscape of distribution right now. About a year ago, you had Southern Wine and Spirits and Glazers combine, and then become one of the largest coast-to-coast distributors in the country. And then just recently, within the last few weeks, Breakthrough Beverage, which was a combination of Wirtz Beverage in Chicago and Charmer Sunbelt up in the Northeast, they just reached an agreement to combine with Republic National Distributing Company, which is strong in the South and things. So there's kind of this this consolidation amongst the distribution tier that the big guys are getting bigger. And it's I'm not saying that's necessarily bad for the industry, but it's definitely going to change the industry in how some of these smaller spirits like ours get to the marketplace. In some markets, we work with very small distributors, and others like Chicago, we work with Breakthrough. We're part of their craft portfolio, and they do very well for us. But it's going to be really interesting to see how things change over the next few years as some of these big guys continue to get bigger, and how does that next tier of distribution kind of fall in line with some of the medium-sized to smaller-sized brands that are out there, and how do they get to the marketplace?
Yeah, you said the bigger guys are getting bigger. I think they usually call those monopolies, but we'll see what happens, right?
I didn't say that.
I did. I'll put myself on the line. So the other thing, you know, you said you started this operation around 5 to 7 years ago. So kind of talk about the growth of your business and just the distillation and the amount of equipment, the amount of barrels, the aging process, everything that's happened, like, from the beginning until today.
It's kind of comical because this week is our anniversary, and it seems like whenever this rolls around, you start really thinking back to how you got started and what this place looked like, you know, 5 years ago, 7 years ago, that kind of thing. And we've really grown exponentially just within the last couple years. We've tripled our brewing capacity in the distillery, bought a new ferment, went from 3 fermenters to 6 fermenters. They were 500 gallons. Now we bought 6 1,500 gallon fermenters. We've gone from a 500 gallon mash tank to a 1,500 gallon mash tank. We found was spending our money to make more product to send through the still would get us more product in hand than just having a still that, you know, we could run longer. The thing about a bigger still is it's going to distill at the same speed. It's just that you don't have to fill it up as many times. So we're still using the same still. But it's, you know, we started off with, we thought we were excited to have, you know, the first 20 barrels laid down, and now we have almost 900 barrels sitting downstairs waiting for the sun to come up every day. So, and plans to continue to grow that. It's, we've gotten to a point from a business standpoint of enough capital running through the operation that there's enough reinvestment available to be able to really take a big step forward as far as what we're laying down. And what we'd like to do next year is to be able to lay down 3 to 4 years worth of whiskey so that everything that we put down is collectively getting older and higher quality and all that stuff is happening together. We haven't taken the tact of, okay, we're going to have this stack of barrels that's going to be 10 years old or whatever, because there's really no chance to make a huge difference in the marketplace with just a little bit. It's to constantly improve the quality of the product that we're putting in the bottle. I don't think somebody that picked up a bottle last January and picks one up this January is going to notice a sizable difference. I think if you lined them up over time, I would hope that you'd notice, oh, this is getting a little smoother. This is more balanced. I like this a little bit better than that. But that with the extra age, that the quality is slowly evolving and getting better and better every day. And that's what we've tried to do, is just learn from the mistakes that we make, learn from even some of the successes that we have, to every day try to improve upon it in some way, a little bit here, a little bit there. Maybe it's in our yields and our fermentation. Maybe it's in the way we distill and what we're getting out of this or that, or what we're using for water, what we're using for grain, those kind of things. Tweaking with it, experimenting, trying a different barrel here or there, setting those back, seeing how they go, so that your knowledge base and your experience base is always expanding and putting yourself in a position to continue to bring something unique and better to the marketplace every day.
So what was that moment, right? When you had your distillery up and running and you tried a few things, and we've all been there. We all, you're easiest considered a startup, right? And maybe it's 6 months or a year in, maybe 2 years in, you thought, like, we're in over our head. Like, what were we thinking, right? But when was that point when you said, this is, like, we're onto something good here, right? Like, let's keep going.
Yeah. The first year is an absolute blur.
It's like having your first kid, right? Yeah.
I was just going to say that. You don't sleep. It's probably best I don't remember it all because it was so crazy. But when we released Cody Road Bourbon for the first time, we had made an announcement, on our Facebook page and our newsletter and whatever, we're going to have the first batch available. And it was not long before Christmas. And I guess I was stupid to think that people wouldn't be excited about it. I didn't think people would be excited about it. I was not prepared to park my car and come around the corner to see people lined up almost two blocks down the street to pick up a bottle of our first bourbon. And that was like, wow, we've got something here. And I guess they hadn't tried it yet, so it could have been terrible. But the community, the local marketplace has been so good to us from the very beginning. And days like that stand out in my memory of like, where you really get to share with the people that have put you here and the people that have had your back from the very beginning. That was an exciting day. Here this week on Thursday, we'll be releasing our anniversary. We always take an old barrel and bottle it special for our anniversary. So it'll be a 5 year old. It's our 7th anniversary, but the whiskey is 5 years old, and this will be the oldest whiskey that we've, sold. And so we're going to have a night in the bar, our new bar. They just changed the law in Iowa so we can sell by the glass. So, Garrett and I will be signing bottles and celebrating with the folks that got us here and see how the 5 year tastes. So,
well, good. So I'm sure that the gradual progression of the 2, 3, 4, 5 is exactly what you anticipated, in regards of the maturing process.
I'm always amazed at the effect of wood, and how I mentioned earlier, how one barrel can vary from another barrel. We typically blend 8 barrels for product consistency sake, but our single barrel projects never cease to amaze me. And to our anniversary barrel last year was a sister barrel to this one. It was 4 years old last year, and now this one's 5 years old. But they're very different. The last year's was much sweeter. This one seems to have a more of a oak flavor, and it's just I think that barrel experimentation is kind of the next frontier for craft. I think there's so much fun, cool things to do with wood that can really put a twist on a whiskey that might not expect. And so that's coming down the pipe. We're working on, we have a project we do every year for Chicago's Whiskey Fest. We get together with Few Spirits out of Evanston, Journeyman Distilling from Three Oaks, Michigan, and Corsair from Nashville. Each of us contribute 30 gallons of whiskey. They send it to us in LeClaire. We blend it, let it marry, put it back in the barrels, and then release it. We've done a bourbon, a rye, a malt whiskey, and then we did a blended whiskey where it was everybody did a different grain. This year we're doing bourbon again, but we put it into used tequila barrels. And so that will release in Chicago coming up in, I guess Whiskey Fest is coming up in March.
I mean, so you really think that, I mean, we had talked about this before, right? Because anybody that's not, they're just listening right now, you don't get to see that Ryan's actually in his car and he's got 4 whiskey barrels literally behind him that he's taken to a brewery to go and make, basically barrel age something. And then, we talked about before that, and you had mentioned that there's a lot of cool things you can do with wood and the different ways that you can put out a product. And, it's always, you always see that a lot with beer. You don't see it too much with bourbon. So it's going to be exciting to kind of see which, not necessarily bourbon, but you're essentially a whiskey at that point, but it's going to be really interesting to see what are those experiments going to come out as.
Right. And it's not for the bourbon purist, it's not going to provide the flavors that you're looking for. And we get that. But again, going back to craft, trying to provide something different, I think that the vibrancy of the oak used to make bourbon, you're always using a new charred barrel, gives you great product consistency, but it also hides some of the nuances of the base spirit. So to take an aged spirit, put it back into a used barrel, you start getting to that world of scotch of, well, was this finished in a sherry cask? Was this finished in a used rum barrel? Something like that. And it really can put a twist on a familiar spirit in a new way. And I think that experimenting with barrel sizes, different barrels, aging in one barrel, finishing in another, those kind of things are a way to take a quality familiar spirit and make it totally new again in a different way that I think craft will bring to the marketplace, just because, we have the ability to go throw a couple barrels into a tequila cask and say, let's see how this goes. So, I certainly wouldn't apologize for that in the marketplace. I think you'll see more and more of it, and hopefully just be a new kind of vein of whiskey that we probably haven't even thought of yet.
And I really thought it was interesting there, your collaboration for Whiskey Fest. You see that in the craft beer world all the time. You see breweries that collaborate on different things, but you don't hear too much about it in the whiskey world, right? And it's because whether they don't want to share or whether they're like, oh, it's my yeast, like stay away from my yeast. I don't really know what it is, right? But it's cool to actually see that happening inside of the whiskey realm as well.
And, we've been doing this. This will be our 5th collaboration. And to my knowledge, I don't know that anybody else in the country has pulled it off yet to this scale. It's a regulatory nightmare to get set up to transfer spirits between distilleries, blend them, bottle them back out, whose license does it go, all that kind of stuff, especially multi-states and all that stuff. But once we got it figured out, then it makes it easier to replicate year to year. So, it's been kind of fun to be on the leading edge of some collaboration like that. And I think it's the spirit of craft to work together. So we're really pleased to be a part of it with those 3 other guys.
That's real cool. So while we wrap this up, I got one more question that I didn't ask before. Mm-hmm. Like we talked about Cody Road, where the name Cody Road came from, but you didn't talk about where the name Mississippi River actually came from, or the Mississippi River Distilling Company, right? Like, did you guys, like I said, did you all like look outside your window and say, oh, there it is, we got our name, right?
Yeah. Well, it was funny. We had a slew of other names that we were working on, and it was another friend in the industry who looked at us and go, are you guys idiots? There's a Mississippi River is right there. Why wouldn't you use that for your name? Oh yeah, that's a pretty good idea. I will say in retro, it's worked for us and against us. It's a very long name, you know, to write sure. out that kind of thing. But we do some export business in Germany and Australia. We just sent 200 cases of rye whiskey to Canada, to Ontario, which the LCBO is selling. And I think it's really hilarious that Canadians are drinking rye whiskey made in Iowa. but you can say to someone from Germany or Australia, the word Mississippi River, that means something to them. You know, it's a landmark in our country that they can associate with. And so sometimes we have trouble getting people to understand that we're from Iowa, not from Mississippi. But it's literally right out our back door. I look at that river every day. And, right now we've got the Eagles moving in for the wintertime and things like that. It's gorgeous. It's about, 100 yards out of our back door. You can dip your toe in the water. So we literally sit right on the banks of the Mississippi River where I-80 crosses. So we're right halfway between Chicago and Des Moines. If you're ever driving back and forth there, about a mile off the interstate, you got to jump off and see us.
Well, I was about to say, I want you to give everybody information of where they can go, how do they sign up for tours, social media contact, all that good stuff.
Yep. Our website is mrdistilling.com. Looks like Mr. Distilling. It stands for Mississippi River, but easy
I'm
going to like
that.
It.
I'm going
to
take that name, Mr. Distiller. Right?
and we're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that stuff you can find through there. But we are literally a mile off the interstate as you cross into Iowa from Illinois. Exit 306, LeClaire, Iowa, and our tours are free. We give 5 free public tours a day, every hour on the hour. First one's at noon, last one's at 4 o'clock. We have a cocktail house where we make cocktails with our spirits. It's open late every night, so you can come and have a drink with us. And we sell the bottles on site as well. And we just encourage people to come check it out. We have a brewery next door. We have a winery down the street. The American Pickers are in town. So it is a great small town to come and just experience a little bit of Americana in a whole new way and have a little to drink while you're at it.
And say, get drunk and take out some antiques, I guess, right?
That too. Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, Ryan, I want to say thank you again for coming on the show today. It was great to learn about, you know, the unique things that you all are doing, right? I think that's one thing that we always get we get too comfortable with what's out there, right? And you expect something to always taste the same, or, you know, you have these minute differences by some of the big guys. But, you know, when you talk to somebody that wants to take a hard left and try to bring out something that is completely unique and allows you to maybe put something out during a tasting or during a blind tasting and say, what do you think of this, right? And it gives that ability to people to start opening their eyes to seeing, you know, there are other things out there, right? That you can drive away some of the taste buds that there's you're not going to expect the same thing every time. So I think it was really cool and kind of seeing how you are progressing as well as the products you're putting out. I kind of want to try that artisanal spirit now that you talked about it earlier, like see what this is all about. So, but again, thank you for coming on the show today.
I really appreciate the time and giving a voice to craft, and hats off to everybody. Hope everyone has a wonderful holiday.
Well, good deal. So if you like what you hear, make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also support the show by going to patreon.com, patreon.com/bourbonpursuit. All of our recordings that we do on Hangouts are always available to our supporters so they can actually join in and come and ask questions. And make sure not only just follow Mississippi River Distilling on all those great social media channels, but you can follow us as well, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram @bourbonpursuit. And with that, we will see you all next week.